testify in front of you today on Senate File 364. Before we get going too far, Mr. Chair and members, I do have an author's amendment, the AO90030 amendment.
Do we have a quorum?
Don't have a quorum yet, but you can go ahead and start your testimony based on your author's amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As Minnesota puts an increasing focus on water quality restoration and protection, drainage management is increasingly important. The Drainage Work Group has been able to bring many different stakeholders' perspectives together to identify consensus recommendations for improved drainage management. Senate File 364 is another opportunity to implement the cooperative work of the Drainage Work Group to advance drainage management in Minnesota. I would like to thank you, Mr. Chair, and other members of the committee for your past support for a bill we passed in 2007 relating to the same topic. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to turn it over to Al Keen with the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources to walk you through the bill.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Al Keen. Serve as the chief engineer for the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and I also serve as a facilitator for the stakeholder drainage work group. In your packets today, there should be two documents that will help us review what this bill entails. The first one is one that shows topic drainage. It's off of the Bowser website, and it does have then information about the drainage work group, some of the past work of the work group, and the current recommendations that are contained in the bill. I point out that, in fact, there are more than 20 entities who are members of the drainage work group, different associations from many different perspectives, state agencies as well, who are involved in drainage management, and we also have periodically legislators and or staff who attend. This work group has been around since about 2005, and if you recall, in the 2007 session, there were bills to carry some recommendations that the work group had put forth at the end of 2006 calendar year, and in fact, those were a significant list of clarifications of different aspects of drainage law, which are shown on page 2 of the handout I referred to. What we're focusing on today, then, is the 2007-2008 consensus recommendations of the drainage work group. And there's four primary areas that these recommendations address. Two sections of drainage law that were brought to the attention of the drainage work group that clarifications would be desirable. These sections are used significantly for impoundment type of projects such as wetland restorations on public drainage systems. And the work group did work through a number of clarifications and recommendations for revising 103E227, the impoundment and diversion portion of drainage law. What I'll refer to you also then as a backup that you can review at your own time that works for you is this document that is the summary of the Drainage Work Group consensus recommendations for 2008. And I would just point out that this document includes along the right margin explanations of the different proposed changes to drainage law for the different sections that are being recommended as modifying. So that will be supplemental explanations, of which I'll just give you a brief overview. But in 227, one of the reasons that we're looking to update that section of drainage law is that it really had never envisioned the type of project that we often run into now, and that is a rerouting of a drainage system. If a ditch or a tile needs to be rerouted around a wetland restoration, for example, or some other type of impoundment, this section of law just didn't envision that type of a situation. It's a quite common one today. So therefore, that was a motivating factor for updating that section of law. There was also motivation to enable partnerships between programs, project proponents, and drainage systems so that multi-purpose projects involving drainage infrastructure can be put in place more easily as a partnership type of project. And one of the things that I'll point out there, a reason for that, is that sometimes, for example, if there's a tile system that is in very low ground, it tends to blow out periodically. It's a maintenance problem for the system or for the landowner. The landowner decides to enroll in a program, then this proposed changes, revisions of drainage law, would enable that type of project for the drainage authority to consider the saved, if you will, separable maintenance costs. So the project or the system would no longer have a maintenance associated with that section of drainage system that may be problematic, and that's a consideration then for the drainage authority in determining whether or not the drainage system should partner on a project. Moving to Section 805, 103E805. This section of law is currently about two functions. It has a removal of lands from a drainage system, and it also has partial abandonment of a drainage system. And in our experience working with drainage authorities, using that section of law, there's oftentimes been confusion because those two functions are mixed in a way that it's not clear which pieces of that section go to which function in terms of the process. And that is sometimes then difficult for the drainage authority to work through with a project proponent. So the fundamental proposal of the drainage work group in regard to 103805 is to separate those two functions into 103805 for the removal function, keep that one where it is, if you will, and to separate out then the partial abandonment function into the recommended 103E806. So that's a fundamental part of why that recommendations for revisions came forward. And another thing just to be aware of is that the criteria laid out in current 103E805 are not changed. So the criteria, if you will, for the drainage authority to determine if they should or should not approve a removal or a partial abandonment are kept the same, if you will, as they are in the current law. That's particularly true for the partial abandonment. The same language is being used. Two other pieces of recommendations from the drainage work group involve dollar limits within Chapter 103E. Last session, you may recall that there were two bills put forth to increase the drainage system repair fund. And that bill did not go through last year, and therefore that question was brought to the drainage work group about whether or not the stakeholders believe that that was a good change, and if, in fact, there maybe were other changes in numbers, if you will, dollar thresholds and limits within Chapter 103E that should be looked at revisions. And, in fact, the drainage work group did take a look at a number of those dollar limits and thresholds, did some history about when they were last changed or adopted, and through then an inflation calculator using the Federal Reserve method, if you will, came up with some recommendations for updating some of those numbers. And there's also a few cases where the recommendations are to remove some numbers that are in law that were believed to be outdated or unnecessary and therefore help clarify for drainage authorities current limits and thresholds. One more recommendation that the drainage work group has made through its consensus recommendations is to continue to provide state cost share for drainage records modernization. If you recall, the last, in the current biennium, 2007 session, there was funding provided to the Board of Water and Soil Resources to first develop drainage records modernization guidelines, which in fact we had done in fiscal year 2008, In fiscal year 2009, the legislature had appropriated $500,000 for drainage records modernization cost share. And in fact, we have put that out to drainage authorities. There were 44 drainage authorities, counties, and watershed districts who applied for that funding. 22, about half of them, we were able to provide that cost share. And in fact, then the drainage work group is recommending that that state, local, if you will, effort continue. I would point out to you that that $500,000 that's being recommended by the drainage work group is currently not in the governor's budget, but it is in fact then in this bill as part of the recommendations of the drainage work group. And with that, I would just point out to you also that in the audience today, we have a number of members of the drainage work group who are part of helping to develop these consensus recommendations.
We have them raise their hands, please. Thank you. Just want to know you're out there. Appreciate you being here.
And with that, I would stand for questions.
Why are you considering rerouting a drainage system around a wetland restoration? Why not use the wetland as in a way to assist the drainage?
Mr. Chairman, members, good question. It's all about elevation. If there's enough topography that, in fact, a drainage ditch or a tile can be outletted into that wetland restoration, for example, that's typically what's done. But if the elevations are such that in order to maintain the function of that system upstream of that restoration, the only way to make it work is to reroute around the system, then that's oftentimes what is done.
Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 4, it includes a recommendation to require mail notice to all owners. That's not being done now?
Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me, Subdivision 3, the hearing.
Members, in fact, it is being done. And I have to get to the right spot here. Mr. Chairman, members, for 103E227, there was a desire on the part of the drainage work group to not just do a notice, but to also include, I believe, the mailing to ensure that all of the members of the drainage system were notified. And Mr. Chairman, I would just ask Senator Ingebrigtsen to highlight again, which section were you in?
Your document, page 4, subdivision 3, midway through the page there. It's on the right-hand side. It includes a recommendation, it says.
Okay, and that actually is then, Mr. Chairman, members, under current 103-805. And I believe that, in fact, all right, so we're adding that language under 806. It's similar to what is under 805. So if we go back to page 3 of the consensus recommendations, we should find that under that one.
Location.
I believe that there was, in fact, a requirement for notice.
It might be part, Mr. Keene, it might be part of the author's amendment.
Okay, I'm on the right spot now. If we go back to, Mr. Chairman, members, Senator Ingebrigtsen had referred to the addition of 103E806. If we go back to 103805 on page 3, you'll see that there was a requirement to give notice by publication of the hearing to all persons interested. The drainage work group had recommended that that would be a little bit more definitive in that there was also a mailing of a notice to all members of the system. So all owners in the system the drainage work group is recommending that the notice be heightened a bit to have both a publication and a mailing.
Thank you.
We have a quorum now, and the author has an author's amendment. Would someone be so kind as to move that for Senator Sparks? Senator Stump moves the A09-0030.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Frederickson?
Mr. Chairman, I do have an amendment I would like to make to that amendment.
All right, go ahead.
It doesn't make a... It just clarifies. But I don't know if you would like me to make the amendment now because there's a corresponding section in the bill that I'd like to change also.
Why don't we pass the author's amendment and then you can offer both your changes?
It's going to be... Okay, you want to pass this first?
Sure. Yeah, and then we can just do both changes at the same time. On the amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Frederickson.
And Mr. Chairman, to the amendment, we just adopted the 0030, and also then I would move on line 1, page 1, line 33 of the amendment, delete 2 after publication, and delete all of line 34. And there's a similar section, as mentioned before, on page 6 of the bill, line 17, delete everything after publication and delete all of line 18. And Senator Sparks, this is what I'm going to propose. This is a section about notice for the hearing, and I'm going to read the first part that stays in place: by mail to all owners of all property benefited by the drainage system and by publication. And I'm going to propose adding on a website and in a newspaper of general circulation in the affected drainage watershed. But I think the way it's written now, it's a little unclear as to how you would meet that requirement when it just says other persons interested in the drainage system. It might be somebody clear across the state that's interested in the drainage system. This would more clearly define where you're supposed to notice.
Mr. Keene.
Mr. Chairman, members, I believe that, in fact, the drainage work group was trying to, number one, not make more change to the existing law than they felt was necessary. I can't read all of their minds, but the only thing that I would propose that might be an issue for them is the availability of, in fact, that website. Which one? Is it their own as a drainage authority, which, in fact, maybe all of them do have? I believe that may well be true of all of the counties and the watershed districts. But it is more specific then to them. And I don't know for a fact that maybe some of the drainage authorities may feel that to be a bit problematic in some situations.
Mr. Chairman, I've got to believe that all of the counties have websites. And I don't think that would be very, very onerous. And I think it would be a good way to inform people. And I would say that if this bill, I think, is going to have to go to other committees, they could weigh in between now and another committee if they want to make further changes.
I guess the question is, was the working group specifically interested in people other than property owners receiving notice by mail? Specific.
Mr. Chairman, members, I don't believe they were, in fact, trying to keep the same expectation that's in the law now, that those who are not owners within the system would be notified via publication. It's just not as specific as what Senator Frederickson is recommending.
Okay. All right. Further discussion on the Frederickson amendment, and you can certainly take that back and round robin with your group. Mm-hmm. And if it's an issue, we can discuss it again in the Agriculture Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Further discussion.
Let's go from here, Ag. Yep. Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 364, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Veterans and Agriculture.
Good. Want to understand the motion? Discussion. discussion? Was anyone in the audience interested in testifying in opposition to Senate File 364? See anyone coming forward? All right. On the motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Ready to go now. Who should we take next?
John Dahl's
here. Senator Dahl's here. Senator Dahl, are you ready?
I am.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senate File 477.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 477 is a, it's a unique opportunity for us to be putting forward a pilot project or demonstration project for the nation on post-consumer paint collection, reuse, and proper disposal. Currently, we do that with our county systems, and we've got a program where manufacturers and retailers, in conjunction with supporters through local and state agencies, have developed a proposal in which we can do that through a third-party organization representing manufacturers and retailers to fund the system and implement it. This 477 is the outline of how the program would work and the areas that we'd have to address to get into shape for existing law, and including some reviews and reports at the back end. It's basically a two and a half year project that once implemented and reviewed, if it's found acceptable, will be used as a model for the rest of the nation. I've got several witnesses or testifiers with me to talk about the program, but maybe I'll go through the bill real quickly, give you the key components, and then we'll have our testifiers, if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
Proceed.
If you look at the first section, it's basically the purpose statement. I know a lot of times we don't like the purpose statement here, but this really helps to clarify what it is we're doing. It simply talks about that the reuse and recycling of post-consumer paint. Really, what post-consumer paint is we're talking about is architectural paint, what's used for your walls and things like that, not paint that would be used for the automobiles or equipment and machinery, things like that. Currently, we collect about 600,000 gallons of paint per year. We think we'd like to see that increase through this program. We think we can actually double that. Go to the second page on this. Talk about the pilot project itself and Subdivision 3. Beginning in September 1st, we'll have a representative organization will be set up representing manufacturers. And through this program, they'll set up how we would implement the system using the existing infrastructure of the state. They'd also develop a funding mechanism for paying for this. Currently, we use tax dollars to pay for the recycling and collection of paint, and this would be a program where you would pay for this when you purchased your paint. If you go to section B as well, or C in that section, it'll talk about the educational materials will then be provided. There'll be a determined by this representative organization as to what manner that would be, but to alert the buying public that there is a fee that's included in the purchase of their paint that's used to cover this this particular program. What they'll have to do as well is be able to kind of talk together, the manufacturers and retailers, on what that fee would be. It's not to exceed the cost of the program itself. And because of that, that's why we have on final section of this, on the next page, a provision that would allow, to a limited degree, for the purposes of this program, manufacturers or the organization of manufacturers to work together, and it wouldn't violate antitrust laws that are in place. As of October 15th, 2010, Then there would be some reports that would be due to describe the methods that were used for collecting and transporting and processing this paint, how much paint was collected, also kind of a breakdown on how much was reused, how much was recycled, the other methods of processing. We'll look at the total costs of the program by an independent financial audit that will be paid through by this assessment. An overall evaluation of the funding mechanism to see if that was working the way it was designed to. Also, samples of the materials that were used to, inform the public as to this particular program. Analysis of the environmental costs as well and the benefits of collecting and recycling paint. And then this data would be reported to the commissioner at the end of this program. Then as of January 15th, 2011, then a report would be submitted by the commissioner of the PCA to respective chairs and ranking minority members of the House and Senate committees that have jurisdiction over this. And then finally, the old program would expire on June 30th, 2012. With that, I will turn this over to Ramsey County Commissioner Victoria Reinhardt. She's representing the counties in the state who are very supportive of the program, and she can give more details on their involvement in this program.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. I'm Victoria Reinhardt, Ramsey County Commissioner, and I'm so excited about waste paint. I jumped the gun here a little bit by sitting down right very early. But I am here representing not only Ramsey County, but the Solid Waste Management and Coordinating Board and the Association of Minnesota Counties. And actually, the National Association of Counties also has a plank in favor of the paint product stewardship pilot project that hopefully will take place in Minnesota, because they truly are trying to make this a national model. I would like to thank you very much for inviting us here to speak on behalf of Senate File 477. And what this bill really represents a crucial economic and policy opportunity for counties. It's a culmination of 7 years of national dialogue between government and industry in order to come forward with a product stewardship model that we think works for everyone. Right now, as Senator Dahl pointed out, the current cost of managing waste paint is falling entirely to government. The paint industry, to their credit, stepped forward and said that they wanted to be partners in this and try to figure out a way to make this work with all of the stakeholders, including government, obviously, but from paint contractors to retailers to recyclers to collections to government. They really wanted to figure out a way to make this work, not only in Minnesota, but on a national level. Minnesota was chosen primarily because we have a fairly good infrastructure in place. We have household hazardous waste programs in place that do collect paint and is part of the county costs. And what we're trying to do, or what is going to happen with this, is that the manufacturers will take over those costs and come up with a program that will likely then utilize the infrastructure that's in place, but they need to build on it and they need to change it depending on what the response is to the program. And that's why it's a pilot program, because we don't have all of the answers yet, but we know that we've got a good base to work from in Minnesota. We also have in Minnesota a paint recycler, Amazon, and you will hear from John Sagala shortly. And that also puts us in a really good spot as far as having the not only the collection infrastructure, but also the processing infrastructure in place in our state. The Environmental Protection Agency estimates that 10% of all paint becomes waste paint. In Minnesota, that's 1.3 million gallons of paint per year. Minnesota counties are mandated to collect the waste paint at an estimated cost of $4 million annually, and that is strictly local taxpayer costs, $4 million. With product stewardship, those who make, sell, and use a product are responsible for all aspects of the product, including the waste, causing a feedback loop, especially for producers and consumers. There's a direct connection between how a product is designed and purchased and the ensuing consequences. The paint industry understands this and really wants to take responsibility for their products and to avoid to take some of the pressure off of the counties. Mr. Hirschfeld will talk about this in just a moment as well. Again, this is a pilot program. It ends in June of 2012. We're drawing on our experience from the e-waste legislation, but also from the product stewardship programs that are taking place in Canada. We have some models that we can work with. Drawing together industry and government, we really do believe that we can come up with a program that will work for all involved. We want to, obviously, everyone wants to make the program economical, environmentally protective, and utilizing the infrastructure that we already have in place. We are hoping that, obviously, once this pilot project comes to conclusion, that we will be coming back to make this not only a permanent program in Minnesota, but that it will be taken and go nationwide, which we think would be great. One thing that I want to point out, because this is not a new bill to the legislature, is that last year there was a lot of talk about this being a tax. And we really need to stress the fact that this is not a tax. This is not money that's coming back to the government. It's internalizing the end-of-life management cost into the product itself. It's a recognized product stewardship model that really does work. And with the paint industry taking the lead through the third-party organization and having the oversight built in at the state level through the Pollution Control Agency and the reporting mechanisms in place, we feel that this will really take the financial burden off of the counties, again, to the tune of about $4 million, and especially in these rough economic times for local governments and for state government, everyone involved, it's going to be a really crucial thing for us to do. One of the things that we had talked about also was the fact that, well, if it's being taken off of the property tax, then shouldn't there be a corresponding reduction? The reality is counties are mandated to deal with household hazardous waste, again, including paint, and we spend about $55.9 million. We spent $55.9 million in 2007. The state provided $14 million in assistance through the SCORE dollars. Clearly, you can understand the math in that. The rest of it falls to the property taxpayers. So taking this $4 million off of that will allow us to cover some of those unfunded mandates. And in the end, we also, until it's a permanent project, or permanent program, I should say, we don't want to reduce things and in case it doesn't work. And then we would have to ramp up again. And so we're trying to find that balance in this. It is government's clear expectation that we will be able to reduce these costs from the property taxpayers. And that is what we are trying to do in the long term. Product stewardship can really remove this burden from our constituents, and that's what we're trying to do. And it's also, by internalizing the cost for the paint industry, it's something that will work for them as well. Again, you'll hear from other folks that can speak more to the business side of this than I can, but from a county perspective, this is much needed relief, and it's also something that we feel is incredibly important for the environment. Thank you.
Ms. Reinhart, don't we have an adequate model from the electronic waste recycling programming?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. That we did build off of that, but I think that with each product, there's a little bit different infrastructure within the industry, and so we used what we learned from the e-waste model to come up with what we felt in concert, obviously, with all of the stakeholders, for what we thought would work really well with the paint industry. So, yes, we did learn from that, and you will see many aspects of this are in common.
What would be a couple of the main differences that would necessitate further study as opposed to just making an adjustment and just do what we did with e-waste?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, one of the main differences here, I believe, is the third-party organization that is truly industry-led. It's manufacturer-led. We do have oversight built in, but it's not something that's coming into the state in the same way that e-waste is. So that's probably the biggest difference. It's a true, product stewardship model. It's not easy to say. And with the manufacturers taking the lead rather than the state or local governments taking the lead.
So we're going to figure out here if manufacturers taking the lead, will be a viable method.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct.
And then have you thought about in your assessment about it, or maybe you do, it is in here, about assessing what savings to the county will occur?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is part of the reporting requirements because, again, the fee that is going to be approved ultimately through the Pollution Control Agency cannot exceed the cost. That's from the manufacturer side. But there's also then the report that comes in about the cost savings to state and local governments, and that is included in the reporting.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. One is I have to figure out why the manufacturers are in here, and we're going to hear from them.
So yes.
Okay. If they're coming in out of the goodness of their heart, or there's money to be made here.
I'm not sure if that's a question, but I'll try.
It's Reinhardt.
Not that I care. This is a good thing, but just curious.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, this was, when I talked about it being a seven-year process, this was not an easy process. I think that, and I will let the industry speak for itself, but it got to the point, if I can be blunt, that there was clearly going to be legislation in some states, either one or more, trying to move this forward, where the counties, specifically the counties, in some cases the state, were really saying, you know what, we just can't handle this in our budgets anymore. We're just not going to do it anymore. And so they were going to bring forward legislation that would mandate this. And what the manufacturers, and so what we said was to the manufacturers, look, this is going to happen. And we want to make it work for the industry as well. So what would work for you? And they responded by stepping up to the plate and saying, this is what we think will work for us, and we want to try it out in a state that will work. So I don't know if it's really goodness. Well, I think they have really good hearts because they came to the table. But I think it was really kind of the necessity of, look, we're going to have to take responsibility, and why don't we work together to try to get all the stakeholders at the table and figure out what makes the most sense when it comes to paint.
Mr. Chair.
Follow up?
New subject. I was looking at the conduct authorized in Section 3, starting on the bottom of page 2, continuing at the top of page 3. Does that just envision that just allows the industry to cooperate and collaborate, maybe find one entity to take all this paint and do something with it? Is that the reason for that section?
Reinhardt. Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I believe that Mr. Hirschfeld can probably answer that better than I, but I do know that the anti-compete language, antitrust language that's in this is a requirement at the national level, and they need very specific language that is very limited also to simply implementing this project. It doesn't go beyond that, but it's the language that would allow them to talk to each other. You're absolutely correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, on that point, that is to your previous point as well about the cost. We do not want this to exceed the cost, so it's not going to be a new revenue stream for them to make. But for that reason, they need to be able, the manufacturers, be able to talk to each other and share information that would in other cases probably be start to violate some of these antitrust provisions. And to the extent that they can shape that and form that and create a system where they can at least recover their costs, then this is what we have the language in place for.
Thank you.
Senator Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner or Senator Dahl, do you envision that the pilot program, the paint would be collected at the hazardous waste facilities or more at like the retail level? Would that change or?
Ms. Reinhardt.
Clear on that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stephen, actually the paint manufacturers, they do want to take advantage of the infrastructure at the household hazardous waste facilities. But they have had some retailers that have said we want to take it back at our store. They're still trying to determine exactly what that would look like because they also want to make sure that whatever they do makes economical sense. And to have, you know, 16 different locations in a small town wouldn't make any sense from an economic standpoint. And so they're still trying to determine exactly what that would look like, but they definitely plan on building off of the infrastructure that's already in place.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I will add to Senator Sabin that the whole big part of this is not only is to collect more paint, and so we need to make it more convenient for consumers to do that. So in addition to seeing retail sites that would have an ability to bring paint back, it's my understanding that also we won't be limited to the county we live in to return the paint, that you could return it to any site, any county site that's in place right now. If one happens to be closer to you, than your county's site, you can access that one. And that's one of the other benefits of this particular program.
Well, Mr. Chair, if there's no other questions, I have just a couple other
let's move to the
testifiers.
Yep.
Hans Hirschfield from Hirschfield's Paint and Mike Weber.
Mr. Chairman.
Please introduce yourself.
Members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of Senate File 477 entitled Paint Stewardship Pilot Program. I am Hans Hirschfield, CEO of Hirschfield's, which is a retailer as well as manufacturer of coatings, paint coatings. Hirschfield's is a family-owned business that celebrates over 110 years of existence. We operate approximately 30 stores throughout Minnesota and employ up to 300 people. Hirschfield's and the paint industry are committed to finding a viable solution to the issue of post-consumer paint, which is often the number one product by volume and coming into hazardous household waste programs. This legislation will enable manufacturers develop and implement a post-consumer paint management system for the collection, reuse, recycling, and proper disposal of this paint. The bill has a number of key elements that the industry needs in order to commence this pilot, and most importantly, the financing of such a program. These elements are necessary to address level playing field and antitrust concerns. Competitors cannot agree on the price of products, even for a good cause. And unless all manufacturers and retailers participate in this program, competitive disadvantages will occur. Thus, the legislation ensures that paint manufacturers will fund the program with a uniform assessment to be approved by the Minnesota Council Agency that will be added to the final purchase price of all architectural sales of paint in the state. This assessment will be used to fund paint collection, reuse, recycling, and disposal activities, not only in the areas that are now being serviced, but in additional unserviced areas of the state as well. In addition, stakeholders who do not have access to these programs or who had to pay additional fees for such services will now be entitled to use this program. This means that consumers will now have more places to take leftover paint and will no longer be constrained by city or county lines, and that contractors will now have the opportunity to drop leftover paint for recycling and proper disposal without having to pay a separate fee. Finally, the assessment will go towards consumer education program as well as for the record-keeping and reporting requirements mandated under the bill. To ensure further fairness and consumer protection, the bill specifies that the assessment cannot exceed the cost of the program. The program is proposed, and this legislation has worked well in Canada for over a decade and is widely accepted by paint manufacturers, retailers, government agencies, environmental groups, and consumers in that country. We hope to prove that this will be will also be the case in the United States by starting with this pilot program in Minnesota. Thus, Hirschfield supports Senate File 477, the imposition of the paint pilot stewardship program, and looks forward to working with our retail and consumer partners in the state of Minnesota, Minnesota's local government agencies, and the HHW programs to implement the program on successful passage of this bill. Thank you.
Questions for the witness. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to either to Mr. Hirschfeld or to Senator Dahl. Do we have any wild guesses how much the fee will be, like 25 cents or $5 or $10?
Mr. Hirschfeld.
Okay, great. Thanks. Per gallon.
So if you bought a 5 gallon container, same price as if you bought a quart container. The encouragement is we would like to see more proper purchasing so we don't end up with more paint left over than we need at the point of purchase. However, if you're a paint contractor, you're usually buying 5 gallon containers and responsible with those anyway. Want them to be penalized for using buying large volumes of paint. So we went with one. Kid number. That would again. This is how we send the other kids to it.
I got it. The best method. Explain to me the part where the assessment is included in the cost of the paint sold to the retailers and distributors, and then the assessment goes on the purchase price. So why that double step? Are the wholesalers then going to be in charge of pretty much the program? Is that how it will work?
Mr. Chair, I'll let my
welcome to the committee, and, you know, go ahead and just give your testimony, and then maybe you'll answer it, this question, anyway.
I'm just here to answer questions.
Oh, okay, so. Okay. Well, please introduce yourself and see if you can.
My name's Mike Weber. I'm the Chief Operating Officer of Hirschfields.
Okay.
I've been involved with the task force at hand for the last 2 years. The way that it finally was presented was that the manufacturer, at the time that they ship goods or product into Minnesota, in our case it'd be internal, but if Sherwin-Williams was shipping product into Minnesota, at that time they would include on their invoice the fee as a separate line item. So, for example, we felt that the collection process and the recording process, the retailers felt that it would be burdensome for them to do the recording process. And so it would be in the best interest of the program to work that the manufacturers control the recording process. So in essence, if a paint manufacturer shipped 20,000 gallons into Minnesota for the month, they would be responsible for paying that amount to the independent organization here to fund the program.
All right. Okay.
Now, it's up to each retailer to decide how and if they're going to actually increase the fee to the retail consumer.
That's not what it says.
The bill does say that the retailer must include the assessment in the purchase price.
And you can include the assessment in the purchase price. Again, the manufacturer, depending on, you know, in a free trade situation, the manufacturer can sell to the retailer at any price point they want to. So,
do you want to say that each retailer and distributor may include the assessment in the purchase price?
I don't think so. I think that we want to build this on and keep an equal playing field. One of the challenges we have is you could have a manufacturer that just chooses not to, in essence, pass that on, or the retailer pass that on, and that could become a competitive disadvantage to the other manufacturers that are passing it on.
Sure. Okay. All right. Senator Dahl?
The idea is here is, can we keep in mind this is a pilot project,
Sure.
What we want to do is we want to have equal participation by all parties for this period of time so we can really assess it properly. Once the pilot's over, I think, you know, that could be one of the discussions we want to do if retailers want to extend that feed forward and okay. price their product.
All right. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dahl, so in fact, this is just a, it's not a tax, but it's a user fee. Fair to say?
Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
That's fair. That's very fair. Thank you.
So did you have any other witnesses, Senator?
We have one other, Representative Dahl from the Amazon. He's involved with this up to this point. I would have him say a few things. I do want to also... the Retailers Association, their representatives, said to share with you that they have full support of this program. Contractors, we're trying to get a contractor this year. They also have been had their support for the particular program as well. So, and this is John Segal of Amazon Recycling.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. I'm John Segala. I'm one of the owners of Amazon Environmental. My sister is the other owner. I'm here in Minnesota. I started and managed this facility. We opened here in 1999. Lorraine manages the Southern California facility. I often ask her if she wants to switch during winter, but she always says no. We have been here since 1999. We started out, it was just me. We've since grown. Last fall, we moved to a larger facility. We moved from Roseville to Fridley. Now we're in a 25,000-square-foot facility. I currently have 8 employees. And if this passes, I would expect the increased amount of paint coming in to, I'd probably have to add about 4 more people to my staff. I'm here basically to just give you some idea on what do we do with this latex paint that comes in, this hundreds and hundreds of thousands of gallons of paint. Basically, it falls into 2 categories. Either it's reusable as paint or it's not. How do we know whether it's reusable? I have a crew of people that open up every can and pail that comes in the door and they inspect it. If it, the short story is if it looks like, you know, if you mix it up and you could put it on your walls for touch-up, then it's probably good. If it's got any kind of bacterial growth or rust or started to solidify or curdle, then that paint is going to go into a different process. The good paint we sort by color. And I think that you may have gotten this here. You can see the colors that we sort by. There you go. When we say we want to make a batch of white paint, we'll pump, say, 10 drums of paint into a tank, mix it, pull some samples out, and then do standard paint tests on it. We'll test it for color and sheen, pH, opacity, that is, you know, how well does it cover and hide, and some other things. We'll put in additives and adjust the paint as necessary. Once it's right, we run it through a series of filters, package it up, and that's what we call recycled content paint. Really what it is the same stuff that you have that might be reusable if you stored it properly in your basement, but, you know, with a little bit of quality control going on, and then that's what we turn around and sell.
Is it recycled or is it surplus?
Well, we call it recycled, post-consumer content. Recycled paint, yes, but it's coming in from mostly the household hazardous waste programs.
Well, it's hard. I guess it would be hard to recycle paint that's already been used.
Right, yeah. I get that question a lot. When I first meet people, I say, well, how do you recycle paint? And they imagine that they're scraping it off the wall somehow. And no. That's not what we do.
Someone's a little slow this month.
Strangely enough, just to piggyback on what some of the other folks have said, when I do meet people, they often aren't aware that there are places that you can drop off paint. In spite of all the programs we have and how much is collected, lots of people either are only vaguely aware. So I think that this program that we're talking about is going to enable lots of people who otherwise don't even know that there's an opportunity to recycle their paint material to do so. Also, another group that Hans mentioned was private sector. It's not just painting contractors that don't have access to this. It's churches. I have calls all the time from organizations like churches and schools who are not able to use the household programs. They want to do the right thing, and so they're driving to my facility now in Fridley from, it could be Dakota County or Scott County or from anywhere, to drop off 5 or 10 or 20 gallons of paint, and then they have to pay me to do it. I usually give the churches a break, but nevertheless, they'll all now be part of this program and be able to have access to the program. Back to my paint real quickly. We make a pretty good quality paint. I think you have a flyer here. We are any day now going to be approved by Green Seal, which is the national organization that approves recycled and environmentally preferable products.
Green what?
It's called Green Seal.
Okay.
They're based out of Washington, and they approve all kinds of things. We also have our paint is periodically tested by an independent lab called the Master Painters Institute. They're very well known in the paint industry, four times a year, and so far we've passed all those tests where we submit our paint. We unconditionally guarantee our paint, and we haven't had any complaints or returns in 5 years. That includes Minnesota and California. So we feel like we're doing a pretty good job of quality control. We sell it for about 50% less than the cost of comparable quality virgin paint, $40 for a 5 gallon pail or $13 for a gallon. So it's a pretty good deal for people that want to try. The non-usable paint, about half of the material that comes into us has been stored improperly or is so old that it's not usable. If in Minnesota, if you store it in your garage for one season, it's gone through 10 or 20 freeze-thaw cycles, and the paint's not going to be any good. What we do with that is we have a patented process where we mix that paint with a dusty byproduct from another process. For example, we can, here in Minnesota for years, we're using fly ash from a coal-burning power plant, an Excel-burning power plant. That coal ash mostly was just going to landfill. But the chemistry of that coal ash really has, there's a lot of minerals in there that are useful in the manufacture of cement. But the material itself, the ash, is too dusty for a cement plant to use. Some plants do have the capability to handle dusty materials. Many don't. So we mix it with the paint. We end up with a product like this that basically is very similar to clay or shale that the cement plants mine out of the ground in order for raw feed. And we send that to them, and they can replace some clay or shale with this, we call it PLP, processed latex pigment. So we're not only recycling the not usable paint, we're also reusing another waste stream. It could be fly ash. We've also used lime kiln dust. And we could also actually use cement kiln dust from the cement plant. Same kind of story as they generate this dust. It's not usable. We mix it with the paint, and boom, they can reuse it. So
you can make a road out of that. Is that what you're saying?
Actually, this is being used at the plants that make the actual powder that actually make the cement. So that's going to – it could end up in a road. It could end up in this building or on a sidewalk. Absolutely. Those molecules will end up on your sidewalk somewhere. Yes.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, do we have rainbow-colored sidewalks and roads after that?
No, because if you'll notice, when you mix all these different colors of paint, you know what you get? Mm-hmm. Gray. Every time you get gray. So,
but then are there? I mean, are there dust issues?
We have dust control at our plant. So the way we have this dusty material delivered is pneumatically. I don't know if you want to get into this, but it's actually collected in a pneumatic truck with dust control on it. And it's blown into a silo that we have with bag with dust collectors on it. So we have dust collection all along the system.
Absolutely. I mean, the final product, does that have dust issues? You know,
well, as you'll see, the paint has agglomerated the dust. So that no, it doesn't. It's going to be a solid at that point.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, does it make any difference if you buy low VOC paint or other kinds of environmentally friendly paint? Does that change how you process it later?
It doesn't change how I process things. Mm-hmm. As more and more low VOC paints come on the market and people purchase that, then the paint that I make eventually will become lower and lower VOC, because what I'm getting and making for the recycled content paint is basically an average of what was sold maybe last year or 2 years ago. So I can't make low VOC content paint with the paint that's coming in, because it's kind of a mix of everything that's on the shelf.
Senator Stephen.
Mr. Chair, and maybe this is more for Senator Dahl, but it seems like this is a great bill and a great idea, but is Amazon the only receiver who can receive all this excess paint? And what happens if we get so much paint that your company isn't able to absorb it all?
I can answer. We've been involved in the paint product stewardship group for 5 or 6 years. actually from the very beginning. I think it's 6 years now. There are a number of other paint recyclers across the country, but there are relatively few in any given region because you need quite a volume of paint in order to make it a viable business. Right now, I am the only paint recycler in the upper Midwest. We get paint delivered here to Minnesota from as far away as Texas, Saskatchewan, Canada, North Carolina, Kansas City. It's all coming to me because there are no paint recyclers out that way. So, and why did I move to Fridley? I moved to Fridley because last year I thought this paint recycling bill might pass, and I was looking forward to this avalanche of paint that might come in my door, and so we geared up for that. We are ready to handle it.
You know, you have solid representation in the Senate. okay, so if there aren't any more witnesses, I do have one person on the agenda, John Ness, who wanted to testify. And while that person is coming up, Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, I was just trying to figure this out. I represent southwestern and western Minnesota. You can walk across the road and you'll be in Iowa. You walk across the other way, you'll be in Dakota. Is this going to be extra money going to be just for Minnesota?
Senator Dahl?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite get the question. There was, if you're right on the border, and so I'm not sure what your question was, Senator Vickerman.
Could you repeat the question, Senator?
Well, I'm trying to figure out if you're going to put Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, if you're going to add a little bit of money to the paint in order to recover the cost. Is that okay? Well, I'm saying if it's just Minnesota, if I was where I live, I'd go over to Dakota. I'd go to Iowa and buy paint, like buy it cheaper.
20 cents.
Well, that's just what I'm saying, because when I go back home, they're going to say, what the heck did you do? So let's get on the same page. I'm all for it, but I might need to be able to understand that.
Well, one thing you could say is that those people in other states are going to be paying higher fees at the county level for paint recycling. Now they've just built this paint recycling program into the cost of the product without the government having to levy another tax. So we're trying to save taxes. And if they imagine if South Dakota or Iowa's got a paint recycling program, they're probably paying through the local government. And so that's what we're trying to do here is save another tax.
Mr. Chair, maybe Reinhart could address that too.
Ms. Reinhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mm-hmm. This was an issue that was brought up last year as well, and in fact, specifically in Hastings, my hometown, which, of course, borders Wisconsin, and why wouldn't people just simply go across the border and get the paint? Last year we were talking about something to the tune, and we don't know what that user fee will be, really, but about 25 cents per container. It could be a little bit higher, it could be a little bit lower, but you're not talking about a massive price difference when you're talking about it on a per-gallon basis. And so it really, even, you know, some of the border cities were concerned about that, brought it up as an issue, but ultimately decided that it wasn't enough. If you were talking a buck or two per gallon or per container, then people may, you know, rethink it and say it's worth going someplace else in order to get it. But it's not a significant enough amount that it would likely drive people to another state.
Are those border states going to be allowed, their paint going to be allowed to be recycled in Minnesota? Are they going to start coming over to Minnesota and say, oh, you've got these expanded recycling opportunities, we'd like to bring our paint over?
Well,
even though you guys, even though you guys are paying for it.
And he already takes paint from everywhere.
You're working on it, okay? Just something to think about.
Actually, Mr. Chair, each state does have their own program, so you were absolutely correct. Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's still going to come through the household county program is where most of these things are going to be going through, and so I'm sure they're going to be checking those things to see if they're residents and the like. So, again, it's just a pilot project. That's what we want to find out is some of these questions. You know, how is it going to affect the marketplace? Manufacturers and retailers still want to sell their paint. They don't want to add an excessive fee on here. They want to keep to a point where it's so marginal. No one's going to spend the extra gas to drive, you know, 10 miles away to the next town to buy something. At the same time, we don't want an influx of folks coming across the border to dump their paint either. So, but those, this is the why we have a pilot project to work out any of those questions that might arise when we through the implementation.
So this is going to be for a year. Is that correct?
Well, essentially, it's a 2-year project. The first set of reports comes out, I think, in a year. We sent the first set of reports so we can see how it's working. And then as of 2012, I think it's September, June 30th, 2012, is when this would expire. So,
okay. All right. Was Mr. Ness here or someone from the
Minnesota painting? No, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. He was to represent the contractors, and he couldn't make it today.
Okay. All right. Does anyone want to testify in opposition to Senate File 477? Seeing anyone approaching, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of comments or questions. One on page 3 of the bill, Senator Dahl, you talk about exemptions from state antitrust laws, et cetera. Aren't there federal laws to be concerned about? Is that a concern?
Senator Anderson, that's why we want it. We have this in here is to address those issues on this level to give some exemptions. This did go through judiciary last year, and they parsed those words pretty good. And it's modeled after the e-legislation or e-waste legislation so that we're dealing with some of those same issues. And also, that's another reason why we have the purpose statement is necessary for the Minnesota exemption from the antitrust qualities and for this particular program versus the national antitrust. That's why we have that purpose statement in there.
Well, Mr. Chair, my other comment was actually about the purpose statement, and I wondered if it would work to say to just change it a little bit and to say, and I don't know if the Judiciary Committee would want to have an opinion about this, but I worry that it might be deleted somewhere in the Senate. But you could say instead, an environmentally sound and cost-effective paint stewardship pilot program is created, and the program must undertake responsibility, et cetera, promote the reuse, collect, just define it as a program, and then it's operative language, and I don't think anyone would object to that in the Senate. It's just a suggestion for just redrafting that language a little bit that might protect
it. Senator Anderson, I will take that,
you could work with
wise suggestion, and I'm sure they're going to, want to go over it again with a fine-tooth comb, but we can certainly introduce that. Most of this language we've gone over many, many times with all the parties involved to make sure that everyone's comfortable, and they vetted it with their attorneys, and so, but what we'll do is take this and make sure that we can add that to because your point is well taken.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Anderson,
in that case, I won't move an amendment. I'll let you just bring this idea back to all the groups that have worked so hard on this.
Senator Frederickson moves that Senate File 477 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Business, Industry, and Jobs. Is there a discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Appreciate it. Next on the agenda is presentation on aquatic management areas.
Thompson,
you need to pass some things out? Okay, just set them there. We'll pass them out.
The commentator on Saturday morning. Not that one. I know that for sure. He lives in my district.
Okay, who's going to begin the presentation?
Good
to give him a hand with that laptop. We'll give you a hand. Could you give him a hand with the laptop and give him this presentation?
And move the mic from this side of the...
Usually you have a little guy. Yeah.
This is interesting.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Dave Thompson. I'm a resort owner from the Otter Tail area. Obviously, I'm not a technical person here. I represent, for this meeting, I am the current co-chairperson of the DNR Aquatic Management Area Acquisition Program, and it was a committee put together by DNR in 2007 to put together a long-range plan for aquatic management acquisitions for the DNR. We spent one year on this committee and formulated this plan. Normally this is a two-person presentation with DNR and I, and so the people on the plan that were on the program are on a slide later on, and I'll get to that. DNR acquisitions are done in many different ways, as you can see. There's wildlife management areas, which many people are familiar with. There's water access sites, state forest areas, state parks, eco-resources, scenic areas, and aquatic management areas. The importance of aquatic management areas are that they're native shoreline habitat. It's disappearing at an alarming rate. On lakes, rivers, and streams, the development is impacting the shoreline, where owners are mowing their entire property down to the water. There's no buffer area anymore. Native plants clean rainwater and before it goes into the lake, and so the native plant growth is no longer there, and our waters are becoming increasingly diminished in their water quality. Importance of shoreline habitat is that it protects water quality, prevents erosion, the way it prevents erosion in a lot of cases. For example, at my resort in my area in Otter Tail, typical shoreline is covered area with aquatic emergent plants like bulrushes. A lot of lakeshore owners don't like them and take them out to manicure a beach. Bulrushes tend to act as a dampening effect when waves come across them. It diminishes the wave action on the shoreline and prevents erosion. Also, there's natural beauty and offers privacy. And I can attest to the fact that it discourages Canadian geese and ducks from coming up through it. Why are protecting shorelines important? Most of the surface water in the 48 states is, I don't normally do this part of the presentation. Water quality is the top priority for the public. It affects tourism, which I can attest to. It's a $9 billion a year industry, and it affects the economic growth of the property values. Generally speaking, from what I understand from the real estate market, is that the higher property values are on lakes that have a higher water clarity. Important milestones for you to understand is that AMAs were established as part of the outdoor recreation system in 1992. It authorized the acquisition of AMAs in 2000, designated AMAs in 2000, and a formula for establishing trout stream easements were established in 2002. Shoreline currently protected as AMAs. There's currently 2,100 parcels, including 38,000 acres, 620 miles of trout stream, and 220 miles of lake and warm water shoreline. Here's some interesting projects that are very much worth highlighting. In Cayuga Scout Camp AMA in Crow Wing County, the fee title was $1.5 million. There was 240 acres, 2 miles of shoreline. The partners in this case were the Boy Scouts, Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, and Friends of Scouting. A single donation of $450,000. For the most part, AMA's history that I'm aware of is that through the DNR AMA acquisition, it's very seldom just a single acquisition of money from the state. It's most generally partly donated and coupled with money from other areas like the RIM dollars and that sort of thing. Here's another one, Vermilion River AMA in Dakota County. This is a good indication of trout stream easements where a long stretch of river was protected that allows angler access. It's also in the plan that we came up with. One of the criteria for making an AMA purchase higher on the list a priority is that if it can be coupled with other public ownership already in existence, like in this example, it adjoins an existing WMA. Upper Cormorant Lake in Becker County, you can see all the different parcels of these were all different fee title and projects that added up to this 1.9 miles of shoreline. I'm hoping in the slide that you can see in the upper area of the lake the watercolor difference, where the natural shoreline is versus the lower part of the lake where you can see it's cloudier. I'm hoping that shows up where the roads are and the trees change. You can see the water color difference from where, and that's all has to do with runoff. This is a Luxembourg Creek in Stearns County, and again, it's in a metro area. You can see that the development all around it, and this protected the stream, which is all natural along the stream and allows for angler access. But the importance is to protect the property just adjoining the water so that the runoff is kept clear as it the water runs through it. This is another one in Hubbard County on Cabacona Lake. There's many partners involved, 27 acres and a half mile of shoreline, and trout stream easements. This is now normally the part of the presentation that I give and the part I'm more comfortable with. In 2007, we met for a year and helped DNR compile a long-term plan that would give DNR some direction on where this group thought that we should go in regards to AMA purchase. This will give you an idea of the diversity of the people involved. We had Minnesota Conservation, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, Nature Conservancy, Minnesota Waters, Leech Lake Watershed Foundation, Minnesota Land Trust, Trout Unlimited, Trust for Public Land. Fortunately, most of the people on this committee were paid staff and highly educated in aquatics and of plant life, and that's where there's only three people on the committee that are like me that are just conservation volunteers. During this whole process, when there was a question on a committee, we brought in presenters to answer those questions. We just didn't rely on documentation handed to us. We brought people in from all areas of eco services, fish and wildlife, pollution control authority, to make presentations on specific questions that we had. The principles for aquatic management areas to protect the riparian habitat, prevent habitat from degradation, provide access for angling and non-motorized recreation, efficient, effective acquisition processes, education for potential sellers, and partnerships with nonprofit organizations and government agencies and stakeholder groups. Right, currently, we tried to come up with an indication that normal citizens could understand. And on the 2007 column, you'll see, for example, on trout streams, this is each citizen in the United States or in Minnesota currently owns a half a foot of cold water streams in Minnesota. If we adopted this plan by 2032, each person could actually stand facing the water instead of sideways. Same thing for lakes and streams. Very little lakes and streams in, and we're hoping to come up with 1 foot, so in protection. This state map will show that this is a statewide plan. Each area has been given an emphasis where the committee and the experts agree that the most amount of acquisition should be done. This is based totally on critical habitat need. We also wanted the committees to understand that cold water and warm water, in other words, lake water versus trout stream water, should be considered separately when making a decision on acquisitions. They're two different types of ecosystems, and we wanted those considered separately. The other deterrents that are existing that to habitat loss are DNR shoreline regulations, which DNR is currently in the process of reevaluating shoreline regulations. And in my opinion, they should be working harder and quicker on those to get better shoreline regulations in place, get shoreline buffers and buffer strips mandated. Army Corps of Engineer regulations, local unit of government regulations. As you can see, this is where the St. Croix and the Mississippi River come together. You can see in the lower portion of the slide where the Mississippi River is versus the St. Croix. This type of stream and river habitat, without habitat, urban development, the runoff from urban development is just going straight into the lakes and rivers and streams. This is the expenditure history for the AMA plan. It'll give you an idea that we get about 4 miles purchased versus miles acquired and donated miles. You can see that it's about half of what we actually have to spend to get the miles because of donations and other types of ability to match money. The AMA implementation starts at each DNR field office, where people in the local area can go to the fisheries office and have their projects or property looked at, and then it moves up the chain. In current AMA projects, the top is projects that we have current willing sellers and the process has started. It's about 23 units. It would amount to about 14 miles or 1,200 acres. We would be spending in the neighborhood of $6 million to acquire that. The next two categories have, all of these are included. So the bottom one, the radar parcels, the 74 units include the top two. So these are not all added together. So the bottom one is all of the projects that are available that we have in mind at this point. The middle one is projects that we have current willing sellers, but the projects have not, or the process has not been started. So the very top ones are ones that could be finished quite quickly. This is a map that shows where those projects are throughout the state so that you can see that it really is a statewide program. This would just be for the projects that are on that top list. I'll go back on the 23 units list for the $6 million. Okay, that would be the center one, I'm sorry, the priority parcels with current willing sellers. So that would be the $13 million in this slide. The relationship between clean water and shoreline habitat. In this packet that I handed out is the whole AMA plan. It's the spiral bound. And in that plan, on page 10 and 11, you can read the threats to healthy lakes, rivers, and streams. Page 12 shows the national and state focus on clean water. And then on page 13 is the relationship between clean water and shoreline habitat. And then this slide is a slide that shows that land acquisition has an impact on Minnesota's economy for job growth. It requires a highly skilled staff of workforce. For example, at DNR, if we started doing acquisitions at this amount, in lands and minerals, the types of new people that would have to be brought in are acquisitions type people for the paperwork involved in doing all the legal work in ownership change. So at this point, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to do the presentation. There is members of DNR here that can answer any technical questions you have on how AMAs are administered or on any technical questions you might have on how shoreline actually makes the improvement to clean water. And also there's a testifier here, Bob McGilvery from Minnesota Waters, that would like to say a few words as well.
Questions for Mr. Thompson? Let's have the other testifier come to the table then.
Probably trade be a little easier.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Hi, I'm Bob McGilvery, and I have for several years been a board member of Minnesota Waters. Prior to that, I was a board member of the Rivers Council of Minnesota, and I'm currently employed by the Trust for Public Land, and I had the privilege of also serving on the planning committee that Dave referenced. I just wanted to say a few words in favor of considering using the clean water money for protecting riparian habitat, and particularly the AMA program. There is a very strong connection between water quality and preserving shoreline habitat. The primary area in which this occurs is by stopping runoff. If those lands are developed, the chemicals and sediment flow directly into the water. And, of course, on the other hand, if you have natural land cover on those riparian habitats, you have natural filtering that occurs to keep sediment out and to keep those chemicals out of the watershed. Another way of thinking about it is what some people call the gray funnel effect. Natural land cover acts as a green sponge, whereas if you have impervious surface next to the stream or lake, you've got a gray funnel. The chemicals and everything are going right into the water. That also causes what's sometimes called fire hose effect. You get all that water just rushing into a stream, and it scours the stream banks, flushes urban pollutants into waters, and it also causes depositing of sediments into the waters. And, of course, preserving this habitat is great for fish and wildlife as well. And one area that some people aren't aware of is that by preserving the areas along lakes and streams, you also can substantially lower water treatment costs. There's been a number of studies on that you can actually save money by acquiring that land and preserving it in a natural state. It saves you water treatment costs in the long run. And I'm not a scientist. I can't tell you about the details of that, but I do have some background materials here if anyone's interested in them. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. McGilvery. Questions for the witness? Mr. McGilvery, do we have good information on how long we need to hold water when it's coming off surfaces to do the job, to get it cleaned up?
I can't answer that question. I'm sorry.
Does your group or some of the groups who worked with you on this AMA issue talk to local units of government and engineers about rain gardens and rain barrels and other ways to slow some of that water down?
Those are all very important tools for achieving the same goal of having clean water.
What kind of reaction do you get from developers when you talk to them about this?
I think developers are beginning to see the light.
Any other questions? Members, all Mr. Thompson lives in my district, and when you go to his resort, there is quite a drop from the ground to the water, and he has done a nice job of returning that shoreline to its natural state, some of it by design and some of it by, well, luck sometimes and sometimes bad luck, but he keeps working at it, and it really is quite attractive, I think, now to see it in its natural state along Deer Lake.
Mr. Chair, if I could speak on that a second. A few years ago in 2004, my wife and I, as owners of the resort, determined that, you know, we did have a huge erosion problem and a runoff problem at our resort, and I couldn't very well promote the types of conservation things that I do without doing it myself. So we looked into the Shoreline Habitat Restoration Program at DNR. It's a grant program, and we restored 200 feet or 225 feet of shoreline. We did keep 25 feet for a small beach area, so all the new plant life in our shoreline was redone. It was a $30,000 project, which is a co-op between me and DNR over a 10-year period. But aside from that, then on our own, we removed all the old dock system and put in an entirely new dock system at a cost of about $20,000. So we'd have the least amount of impact on our shoreline we could possibly have for our resort business. But what I want you to take from that is that for 225 feet, we spent about $50,000 to have it be better for the lake. An AMA, there are many of these AMAs that the cost per foot or cost per acre is way lower to do prevention than it is to do restoration. Both of them are very important, but in this case, the I hate to use this term, but the bang for your buck is much better with prevention if we could get landowners to and developers to keep from developing sensitive property and shoreline buffers, we'd be in much better shape.
And Mr. Thompson, what is the reaction around the lake been?
Initially, it wasn't very good. Everybody was concerned, of course, that my new bulrush patches were going to migrate to their beaches. But it's interesting now that everybody boats by. I have big signs out in the lake that indicate what I've done. And then we have signs at the resort and college groups from NDSU, because we're so close to North Dakota, come and look at the shoreline as a project. DNR brings a lot of people to come and look at it. The interesting thing is that more and more people around the lake are now not mowing, as many of them are not mowing entirely to the water and just letting the existing plant life that's there grow up higher. And so some are being better about it. I think it's helped a lot to have so many writings in different lakeshore magazines and newspapers and lake associations. That's helping a lot. But we need more examples on each lake of what can be preserved.
And I know we're talking about a specific lake, but have you noticed, is the lake healthier? Are you able to tell that by being around the water?
I do Seshi disc readings, which is an MPCA type reading. I don't turn them into the MPCA anymore. I just do them for my own benefit. Starting in 2000, between 2000 and 2004, I would have a Seshi disc reading of around 15 feet, and I now have a Seshi disc reading in August in the last 4 years of about 22 feet. I can't attribute that totally to new plant life, but I've asked my neighbors if they understand that the water's cleaner, and they say, yeah, and there's plants growing where they shouldn't be, you know, and they try and remove them. But I said, do you understand why the water's clearer? Well, you know, we must be doing something right. The last 4 years, we've had drought conditions in my area. I've had to actually close my resort weeks early because my public access is on the river, and there's only inches of water in the river at that point. So there's no runoff. There's not been any runoff for 9 weeks lots of times in the summertime. And when you finally indicate to people that the reason the water's clear is because there's no rainwater washing sediment into the lake, then they start to get the picture.
Other questions? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Talk to me a little bit about riprap. What you think of that?
My mother's from Minnesota. I grew up in Iowa. And I think riprap is a great place if you have a Corps of Engineered place that you've created, but it's certainly not scenic shoreline. All it does is stabilize shoreline for some wave action. The ice push will push riprap right up on the bank. There isn't a boulder that you could put in the lake that the ice won't push around. When I did my shoreline restoration project, we did it in the fall of 2004. In the spring of 2005, we had 110-mile-an-hour winds in June, so it was just established. The only thing that didn't come out of the water was the natural plants that we put in. All the man-made stuff came out of the lake and was up on the bank. And after the storm, I went out and looked, and this was after one ice season and one windstorm. I had 2 feet more waterward than my neighbors. And when we did all of the excavation work to do the new shoreline, it was all done to be even with my neighbor's property. So natural plant life makes a huge difference, and riprap doesn't do anything really. It doesn't clean water coming off the lake or off of your property at all. All it does is keep a little bit of shoreline banking from being washed in from wave action.
Members, I saw eyebrows go up when he said 110 miles an hour. That was a 45-minute sustained wind that moved across Otter Tail County and took out thousands of trees, and we lost over 100 at our place alone that day, and it just kept blowing forever, it felt like. Senator Phoebe.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your presentation. I have been involved for about 12 years with lakeshore management in the area that I live, so I have about 400 feet of lakeshore, at least 250 of it we have restored back to native, and we've experienced many positive things from it all over the lake. And with our, and it's catching on with the neighbors, but they do like the riprap. It's amazing when you're driving out in a boat with people that are coming up specifically to visit us, and they just think these beautiful homes are the ones with the riprap and the ones with the concrete slabs, I call them. And then you drive by one that's gone natural, and people are like, ooh, why don't they take care of their grass? So it takes a while for people to understand, and it takes a lot of education. Like I said, I've been on my lake management group for 12 years, and we educate every year. But it's very much needed for our lakes and rivers in Minnesota, and very successful.
Thank you very much for your presentation today. We have one left to go, I guess, today. Bruce Monson, PCA scientist, and Mike Sandusky with a presentation on mercury in fish. Welcome to the committee. As materials are being handed out, you can identify yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Mike Sandusky. I'm director of the Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division at the Pollution Control Agency. On my right is Dr. Bruce Monson, a research scientist at the Pollution Control Agency and the author of a study that has appeared recently in the press, which I think is the impetus for our attendance here today. On my left is Ned Brooks, who's the mercury coordinator at the agency, and his presence is signifying that we're available to provide some context for the state to the study that Mr. Monson's going to describe. I believe you're getting a handout, and Dr. Monson has a brief overview for you, and then we'll be open to questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Monson. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Bruce Monson. I'm a research scientist with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I was asked to give a brief overview of this paper that was published. The paper was actually published 2 weeks ago, and our news release on it went out last week. Brief background on this. I mean, my job is to look at fish contaminants in the PCA, and that's been 100% mercury since I've been there for the last 6 years. Yeah, in 2006, we finished a state mercury TMDL, and in that report, I noted that the mercury levels in fish, northern pike and walleye specifically, had gone down between 1990 and 2000. We made that point. It had gone down about 10% over that decade. And so once that was finished, it made sense for me to go back and look at the data that had accumulated since then to see if that trend had continued, which is what we were expecting, that continued 10% per decade sort of trend. So this report, the actual analysis was completed almost a year ago, but the results were surprising enough that we felt it was important to try to get it published and reviewed by other scientists in a peer-reviewed journal. So that's why it recently came out in Environmental Science and Technology, which is a very reputable scientific journal. It was reviewed by four anonymous scientists as well as people in agencies here that reviewed the paper. So this handout here, the first map that I have here just shows you the state of Minnesota, and the dots represent the lakes that I actually have data from that were used in this analysis. There are 845 lakes. In each one of those lakes, there's at least one year of data where there's a standardized length northern pike or walleye. So to do that, you actually have to have lots of walleye or northern pike and do a relationship between the length and the mercury concentration, because mercury goes up with the length of the fish. And so you come up with a standardized size so you can compare among lakes and over time. So in here, we've got 845 lakes in the total state, but I also isolated just the northern lakes and forest ecoregion, because many of our samples have been collected in the Northeast, and so it was important to separate that out from the rest of the state. That's probably enough for that. On the back are the results. These are the two main figures that I've changed a little bit from the paper, but the top one shows the 25-year trend that I looked at between 1982 and 2006, The red dashed line, it shows if we were to statistically draw a line through the data, that's what it would do. It would actually decrease significantly, just under 1% per year. So about what we had expected before was that it was going down at that rate. So that the average concentrations of mercury now or in 2006 are below what was what we had in 1982. But when I did more statistical analysis of the data, we actually found that the model that best fit the data was not a straight line that continued to decrease, but actually a sharper line in the approximately the first half of the data. And then it actually was significantly increasing after that. So this solid line is the model that best fits the data. It's a piecewise regression or broken stick model. And what that ended up showing was that the average mercury concentration in northern pike and walleye, if you compare the first 10 years of this to the last 10 years, in the first 10 years, it actually decreased about 37% over 10 years. And in the last 10 years, 96 to 2006, it has increased about 15%. Now, that was a shocking result, and I felt that it was important to try to find some way to sort of test this to see if it really held up by evaluating the data another way. So the second plot shows essentially a test of this of the findings in the first figure. I split the data between before 1995 and after 1995 because the break in the line above was right in the middle of the 90s, mid-1990s. So I just split it in 95, and I looked at changes that occurred in lakes before 95, if they had 2 years of data and they had and they were at least 5 years apart, I looked at the change that occurred between those years and those lakes, and then I did the same thing for lakes after 1995 and looked at the changes that occurred between 2 years. And what I found was that before 1995, 64% of those lakes, two-thirds of those lakes, actually did decrease, about another third increase. This is before 1995. In the lakes after 1995, it was almost flipped. It seemed to be a reversal in the trend, where we've actually got almost two-thirds of the lakes have increased in between those 2 years, whereas a smaller portion had decreased. In the paper, I had discussed why this is. We don't have much evidence to say why this occurred, but I did discuss two possibilities that seem the most likely, one being that it's from mercury emissions globally. 90% of the mercury that we receive that's deposited in the state of Minnesota actually comes from outside the state. And there have been emissions increases of mercury globally, mostly in Asia, despite the fact that we've decreased mercury emissions in North America and in Europe. But the increases overwhelm that. So there was a documented increase between 1990 and 95, so that could explain possibly some of this increase. Another possibility is that changes in the environment due to climate change could also increase the availability of the mercury getting into the fish, so that we don't, even with the same amount of mercury falling into our watersheds, if there's increased temperature or increased water level fluctuations, and other factors related to climate change that I won't discuss right now. But there are a number of factors related to climate change that could actually cause an increase in the amount of methylmercury that gets into these fish. And so I think with that, that's the summary of the study.
Mr. Brooks, anything to add or identify yourself for the record? Or?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name's Ned Brooks. I'm the Mercury Coordinator at the Pollution Control Agency. And I'll just address a little bit about what we're trying to do to address mercury contamination in fish. As Dr. Monson indicated, much of the mercury that comes from, that contaminates fish in Minnesota comes from sources outside of the state, and it's delivered by the atmosphere and wind currents, crossing the oceans, circling the globe. And those sources are primarily burning coal for energy, mining, the use and disposal of products that contain mercury, products we're all familiar with, like thermometers, thermostats, et cetera, industrial chemical manufacturing, and there's also some natural sources. Of the sources we can control, not including the natural sources, about half of what falls in Minnesota comes from the United States, or North America more accurately, and about half comes from the rest of the world. So we've developed strategies to address our share of that. Dr. Monson and other scientists have determined that in order for Minnesota's lakes to meet water quality standards, we need to reduce mercury that falls in Minnesota from all sources by about 93% based on 1990 levels. We've translated that into a goal for Minnesota emission sources, and that means we need to reduce our emissions down to less than 800 pounds per year compared to about 3,300 pounds presently. So that's about a 75% reduction. We convened a group of stakeholders that met to develop strategies to meet this goal, and that's a pretty ambitious goal, especially in light of the fact that emissions have already reduced about 70%. So we're on top of significant reductions, we're adding another ambitious goal. Stakeholders got together and developed a comprehensive set of strategies to reach that goal in the sectors that are the major emission sources in Minnesota, which is coal burning for energy and other energy production, products, and mining. So we've developed some strategies to reduce those sectors by, in the case of coal-fired power plants, it's about 86%. Mining, it's about a 70% reduction, 71% reduction, taconite processing and other mining, and products, an additional 64% reduction. So we're working on implementing those strategies, and the target the stakeholders established is to reach that by 2025, the year 2025. With respect to the rest of the mercury entering the state, first I'll say, while addressing the releases in Minnesota are only going to address a small part of the problem we have in Minnesota, our mercury goes somewhere else, ends up contaminating fish in other states and countries. And so we feel it's important for us to reduce emissions in our state, as we're asking others to do in their states and countries. So we have been very active with other states in the U.S. to encourage similar reductions in the U.S. as well as internationally. And Bruce mentioned our country, as Minnesota, has been declining in its emissions, as most other developed countries have, while developing countries are on the rise. Fortunately, last Friday, environmental ministers from around the world, convened by the United Nations Environment Program, decided to pursue an international treaty on mercury. So that will hopefully result in the kind of dramatic reductions we need from the rest of the world to make fish safer to eat in Minnesota.
Mr. Sandusky.
Yeah, just to provide a little plain language context that I think most of you are aware of, but to remind you, this state has a long history in efforts to reduce mercury, and I'm not afraid to say a leadership position in the United States in this effort. The mercury TMDL that Ned gave you the calculus for was really a model that's been used by other states across the country to try to attack the same mercury problem. This notion of whether or not the efforts that we put forth in this state can solve our own problem is sort of the framework that's used in the typical TMDL calculation. In other words, there's studies to determine how much pollution can be assimilated by a water body, and then there are allocations made to different sources about reducing their input of the pollutant, whatever it is. And then the calculus has to show, pursuant to Clean Water Act legislation, that you're actually going to make your goals. Calculus for this TMDL was very different, which is why it's been used as a model across the country. No one can show that efforts in this state, we could be Buffalo Commons. We could remove all industrial emissions and sources of mercury, and we wouldn't solve our problem by ourselves because of the numbers that Ned has provided to you. And as a result, this TMDL, as well as others who have used it as a model, is more of a leadership effort than it is anything else. It's to demonstrate that this state principally and then this country is making significant efforts in order to put pressure on others to do the same. And what's significant about this is picture this in your minds. In this mercury implementation work that we've done, we had representatives of all the major utilities in this state, major mines, all the other sectors represented, and they understand this proportionality. They understand the calculus that's going on here. And one thing that I think you all know anyway that hasn't been mentioned yet is mercury is a little bit different from other pollutants in that, this is really a significant neurotoxin. It's been demonstrated, results in declining brain function, very sensitive to the developing ages of our population. So this is a very significant issue for us. And while these results are a little disturbing, it really doesn't change the position of the people that have contributed to the effort on the implementation plan or the TMDL for this state. And I think that helps this state to maintain its leadership position related to mercury. Thank you.
Gentlemen, was the sharp decline in those first 13 years due to North America's efforts or the lack of development in other parts of the world?
I don't think we know that for sure. The scientists are shrugging. So.
Dr. Brooks?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We don't know that for sure, but that period does correspond to a very dramatic decrease in Minnesota emissions and U.S. emissions, and in particular, the kind of emissions that fall closer to the source. Some fall closer to the source, some end up circulating the globe. And the kind of emissions that are easiest to control are the kind that fall closest to the source. So it's likely that that reduction is due to a decrease in the emissions regionally.
Other questions? Thank you.
Welcome.
Anything else from members? If not, we are adjourned.
Stay in this chair.
I have a mix.
That's
unbelievable, isn't it?
That's such leadership.
I should just take this chair with you wherever I go.
Do you want that chair?
Oh, I mean, this is where I sit in the next committee.
Oh, is it?
Economic development, yeah.
I know. We're trying to get it.
Oh, right.
Man, we got a lot of handouts for this. I got a stuff in that folder.
Whole emissions mercury.
That was pretty tough when you didn't really have that technology when they started.
And it's the beginning.
Well, coal burning is getting better, but nuclear is still the way to go. There's 1 ounce of emission coming out.
It's just the waste hazard that's...
Waste hazard, yeah, and they're doing a pretty good job of getting that, too, now. So, you like that.
Well,
wow. He gets it.
I gotta go visit him sometime. Yeah.
I look, I think, I don't see any that need to go to finance.
Senator, I left
a bill.
You did inside?
Yeah, just.
Oh, okay. I didn't.
Yeah, no, it's okay. And I was just wondering how much of that you wanted.
Okay, I'll look at it because I got to stuff so much in here from this one. I'm just going to do this for now and then look at it. I'm going to be in this chair for the next meeting.
Oh, okay.
You can take everything you need, yeah.
Yes, for doing the bill and
here's a pencil if you, is that what you're picking up?
Yeah, I'll make another round.
I didn't use it, so it's sort of identifying the fish things that need. might go someplace else.
WMA stuff.
That's true, too.